Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. Our guest this week is Ken Pickering, CTO of Hopper. Ken, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Andrew. This is great.
So we lucked out with some good weather this winter to get you in.
Yeah, absolutely. It's mysteriously good weather. I always get nervous when it's like late January and we haven't had too many major snowstorms because then it's like, well, what's going to happen in February?
You know it's coming. So Ken, you know, most folks I have on Underserved have a pretty interesting story about what got them excited about technology way back in the day. What was it for you?
My mom could probably tell you this story as well. But when I was like five, I took apart my record player because I was so intrigued by the concept of like a box that you put a disc on and a needle like replicating sound. So I took it apart and I looked at the pieces and I was definitely unable to get it back together again. But that's always been something that drives me is like understanding how things work, like not being content with just like, well, it's a box that plays music. My parents had a TI computer that hooked up to a television. You know, it had like these big cartridges you would put into it. It's like, and so I'd play some games on that and they had like learning programs and stuff, but they had TI Basic book for it. So when you'd boot it up without a disc, it would just be like a TI Basic prompt and I would go through the book and I would just write like what the programs were that were defined. And it was really clunky because it was like a terrible interface to type. But I remember being just totally in love with the concept of making a computer do something, you know, like to be able to just type strings of text and see some sort of output or outcome. And then in public school, we had the Apple IIs and I learned like Logo, like moving the turtle around the screen. And I got to learn a bunch of the more advanced commands. I could do like crazy colors and amaze people with my programming ability, you know, at like age 8 or something like that. I've always just been in love with that. It's always been a natural driver for me. Been good at math, so I ended up going into electrical engineering in college and ended up switching to computer engineering because I missed programming. You know, I love the hardware side of things, but at the end of the day, I missed that kind of instant gratification of computer programming.
But you can't spell geek without EE.
Oh, I haven't heard that one. That's a good one. I am happy I started down the EE path and I did a lot of like calculus. You know, you do like signals and systems and semiconductor physics and you're like, this is fun, but you know, hardware is a bit of a long road. I'm actually in love with the maker revolution that exists right now because when I was in college, those things really didn't exist as much. It was very hard to make like FPGAs and to actually see something tangible come out of hardware. So I think that's what I most loved about computer programming is it was like easy to do, super low cost, and super fun. So running weird apps and games and stuff for your friends and sending them out. Like those are the, you know, I remember I wrote an app that was doing, you remember when you used to be able to like surf the web and get paid for it? They used to have these services. You'd run like the ad bar at the top. So we all wrote these bots that would like click the webs for us. And we'd get like checks from like all these different web sharing, like web click companies. So like, I'm like, computer programming is great. Like I'm making money, like $100 a month, which is great in college at the time. You know, I guess I just loved it forever.
I did a little bit of hardware hacking when I was in college. I downloaded some schematics and went to Radio Shack and got like the copper plates and ironed on the, you know, little circuit board things and then used this really caustic stuff to remove the excess copper and then putting like IC sockets in everywhere and doing some soldering. Yeah. I think I made like a DTMF decoder so like it would hear telephone touchtones and tell you what they were.
Yeah.
I hooked it up to a Commodore 64 and it would log them and stuff. It was difficult, and I was definitely at the edge of like what I understood as far as like resistors and transistors and stuff like that. And I was like, yeah, programming, like I get it's easier. It comes naturally for me, and I can make stuff quickly.
I mean, I always loved robotics, and so I've always loved hybridization. And that's actually why I ended up going into computer engineering, is I like writing software to make something happen in the real world. So I got really into robotics in college. I ended up working actually for the Department of Defense as my first job. And it was working on like vehicles. So I was working on a lot of software simulations, but working with actual physical like military vehicles, which was kind of cool. But then more and more, my career kind of bridged away from that and kind of definitely bridged more into CS and math.
For folks that don't know, as a CTO at Hopper, what does Hopper do? And what are some of the things that you've kind of jumped into there?
So Hopper is an OTA, online travel agency, that uses predictive analytics to predict when flight prices will be cheapest. So people can download the app, put in when they want to travel. Hopper will monitor flights for them and send them a push notification based on data science on when they should actually buy a flight. We do hotels now, starting rental cars. So we're kind of exploding into the travel space, but we're most known for our flight prediction stuff.
Seems like you guys are growing pretty rapidly.
Yeah.
What sort of scalability challenges do you have with people? Is it technology? What tends to be the bottleneck and how do you address it?
All the things. I mean, the biggest challenge we've run into at Hopper is scale of everything, right? So to kind of give context, I started at Hopper. It was about a little over a year and a half ago, and it was 18 engineers I joined. There wasn't much management structure in place. So building that out, and now we're, I think last time I checked, about 118 engineers. So to scale that and change processes and the company itself to accommodate that level of technical talent and the throughput and features and scale, while our user base is also scaling 2 to 4x, you know, and we're targeting, like, of course, 10x this year. So dealing with just the volume of people using our application and the volume of humans coming into Hopper has been pretty challenging overall. It's one of those things, like, I've been there a year and a half, but it feels like I've been there like 3 or 4 years at this point with the time dilation of, like, just all of the things happening.
Yeah, it's like dog years.
Yeah, it's definitely dog years. Like, it's, yeah, I feel it. But I mean, it's like the good kind of challenging. It's the positive kind of, like, you're growing a business and you're doing well and you're getting the positive signal you need to keep you going and sustaining the growth. For me, it's been transformative. It's definitely like the most I've ever done for a company is working at Hopper. And I think a lot of our leadership feels that way. You know, a lot of us are sort of entering uncharted territory with this hyper growth. So, yeah.
So when you're bringing a whole bunch of people in, do you do anything to kind of standardize onboarding or documentation, or how do you make it so that you can bring people in quickly?
So starting onboarding documentation is key, curating interview process to make sure that we, you know, for both cultural and technical reasons, that we're bringing in the right kind of person for Hopper. We've overhauled kind of how we handle culture as a company, because I think as you get bigger, defining what cultural values you're pursuing is actually tangibly important. And then it's even more important when you hire people to make sure that they understand what you're striving towards and what you're doing. So we've kind of used Amazon actually as a backdrop for defining our leadership principles, because Hopper is nothing if not a two-sided marketplace. So we work with hotels and flight providers. We're not an airline or hotel ourselves, right? So they're our customers. And then we work with the external customers and trying to match the two of them together in a travel ecosystem. So Amazon was like a perfect fit for that, because you'd be very hard pressed to find a two-sided marketplace in the world as successful and driven as Amazon.
Now, did you guys start in the cloud, or did you have to move things there? Was there kind of some re-architecting as part of that?
We are halfway through our GCP migration right now, which is intense at the size of Hopper's business, but it's sort of a no-brainer for us to pursue because we can't add metal fast enough to match our business's growth at this phase. So we started out in Mesos and Marathon. We're going to Kubernetes, Docker, a lot of Scala. We use Finagle, which is a Twitter framework for Scala development. Our data science is largely now done in TensorFlow. So that, at the end of the day, why GCP was such a great focus for us is our data stores were heavily HBase derived. So, you know, Bigtable is a corollary there, and using TensorFlow and Kubernetes, which Google, you know, maintains and runs the open source for, sort of made GCP a slam dunk for us.
Now, you mentioned a tech stack there that is technically impressive, but I don't know a whole lot of people. It's hard to find Scala engineers, for example.
Yeah.
How do you kind of work with, you know, having a somewhat more arcane tech stack or less mainstream?
Yeah.
How do you attract, retain, build engineers to work on it?
The good news is when you use an arcane tech stack, it tends to actually recruit engineers for you, right? When you're doing functional programming, when you're using Scala, the people that care about Scala will look at your company. But we don't hire people that have functional programming expertise. It's not a requirement you know Scala. A lot of our onboarding documentation is actually geared towards, this is how we do functional Scala at Hopper. And we have a number of actual hands-on tutorials that new hires can follow to get more up to speed with how we do Scala at scale. So I think the main thing for us is we just hire great engineers, and we are a patient company in terms of getting them onboarded, getting them up to speed, getting them productive. If you just limited yourself to like great engineers that know Scala, you couldn't build a company on that. It's like great engineers that are Go experts. Like, you're not going to find a huge market. There's a ton of people who would love to learn Go, but at the end of the day, you can't really staff a company based on that.
Understood. Now, prior to Hopper, you were at Rue La La, correct?
Yes. I was at Rue La La, which is now the Rue Gilt Group, for quite some time. I started out there running their consumer app division, so the website and mobile apps, and then later became head of engineering there.
My daughter, Caroline, when she heard that I was going to talk to someone that worked at Rue La La, was like, oh, I love that site.
Yeah. Yeah. It was my first foray into consumer. I loved it. I loved my time there. You know, I think working in flash sales is actually a really interesting technical challenge. Like, flash sales on Black Friday, there is not a more apocalyptic scenario you could imagine than driving unprecedented load into all of your systems during like a 10-minute window. But I mean, that's what I loved about some of the engineering challenges there. It was interesting for e-commerce. You know, like, we did things that not everybody did. We made a product that people love. And that really taught me sort of a love of consumer technology. That's why I ended up going to Hopper, is that working with customers in the open market is really intriguing to me. People don't have to use your app. People don't have to download Rue La La and use it to buy goods and services. They don't have to download Hopper and use Hopper for their flight purchases. So writing a great product that people love is a really intriguing challenge. And I think, you know, both companies were customer focused in that understanding that the lifeblood of their business model is 100% delighting consumers with the application. So I find chasing that as a technologist to be really fulfilling.
How do you kind of marry the UI, UX experience and delighting the consumer with the back end and scalability? And is it two different people? I know everyone wants a full stack engineer if they can find them, but do you find that it's just better to divide and conquer, or how do you handle that?
So when I started Hopper, they hired the most brilliant full stack engineers they could find, right? So Hopper was 100% 18 really great full stack engineers. Yeah, as we've grown, we've had to bring in specialists because at the end of the day, specialists can bring DNA into your technology mix that you might not get from full stack engineers, right? People who have been writing nothing but apps for a decade are going to have a different perception of how an app should be structured, how an app should be made, what best practices are. So yeah, I think what we've largely done is divide in different verticals in terms of like we have mobile engineers and infrastructure engineers and backend Scala engineers, data scientists. I think what we like is a full stack mentality and that people don't toss a problem over the fence to be like, well, this is somebody else's problem and I'll just push them a ticket and forget about it. We want people to own what they do, but I think you definitely need specialists to do technology at scale.
And did you have the same sort of philosophy at Inservio, or did you have other lessons learned there?
So at Inservio, yeah, it was interesting because it was a hybrid shop at Inservio. So we had tons of different technology in the mix there because it was a bunch of .NET and a bunch of Java. And so like they had acquired a company. It was like,
and never the two shall meet.
Yeah, exactly. It was like an East Coast, West Coast thing where where Java engineers don't want to write .NET and .NET engineers don't really want to write Java. But, you know, in a universe where we needed to use both, like even having a bridged ecosystem like that, you focus on services and APIs and ways that the two can interact in a way that actually does make sense. But you know, there too, then there were JavaScript engineers because we did a thick client. So there were definitely a ton of technology ecosystems at play. It's actually where I first learned .NET too. And I will say that I don't hate .NET. Like I'm not going to be one of those open source guys like .NET is terrible. Like I find the fact that they have like a self-contained ecosystem was really surprising to me because I had been mostly in the Java universe my career and I never really delved into what .NET provided. So that was actually interesting to learn in Servio.
Yeah, we do a lot of both, you know, in the consulting that we do. We used to be more .NET. Now I would say it's more Java, less .NET, but you know, the line's real blurry. I mean, you change like import and using and, you know, it's pretty darn similar.
Oh, yeah. C# is basically Java with like slightly different primitives, right? Mm. The thing you get out of it that I like is there's like usually one way to do something. You know, like .NET has its core libraries that run the gamut. With Java, you're always including like stuff from Apache and all of a sudden you have 185 jars in your class path just to do a moderately complicated app. So I have to say there is a certain sanity to actually just having that kind of solidified pathway and the architecture doing pretty clean separation of concerns. Like I find that .NET sort of forces a style of programming that is scalable and maintainable. So I was actually pleasantly surprised to learn all that after delving into it.
Yeah, you don't see as much in the like open source libraries in the .NET world. There are some, but I think you're right that there's less decision making on, well, what should we use? There's 9 different options we got to bake off and then decide on one and then gamble on its future, if you will.
Yeah, you know? Right. Do I want to maintain this in the long term is always a question. Yeah.
Will we end up being the open source curators of Xlib?
Oh, yeah. And that's, I think, because, you know, Hopper is largely open source frameworks. And I think our future is going more to leveraging shared services where possible, right? Like using Bigtable instead of HDFS, HBase, or using Kubernetes, like hosted Kubernetes as opposed to Mesos and Marathon. Because I think that at the end of the day, one of the lessons I've learned is to just declutter your tech stack as much as possible and focus your engineering team on what matters, right? If it's not helping customers buy travel on Hopper, then you have to question the importance of it. You have to question like whether it's really important that we own it, maintain it, invest in it, because at the end of the day, it doesn't help our customers do anything. You know, like, should we write an APM, like application performance monitoring system? Probably not, right? We shouldn't probably maintain that because at the end of the day, it's not actually driving any value for our customers.
I actually heard from a manager recently we were talking to at a big tech company in the area. His outlook was, you know, microservices are sometimes a hammer looking for a nail.
Yeah.
People are like, oh, microservices, everything. And you want to apply it and it's interesting and cool and technically challenging. Yeah. But it may not be the right thing for the job.
It's great when there's 5. It's a lot less great when there's 90, you know, and there's a lot less great when there's like 1,000, right? And that's something we go back, because Hopper is microservices, and that's something we go back and forth on, is how fine-grained are they? Like, if two services are always deployed together and they're dependent on one another, are they microservices at that point, right? Because they're sort of define the logic of what a microservice is. So I think really defining your service boundaries and what actually needs to be a maintainable microservice is a serious question that most microservices companies ask themselves at some point, because of just the complexities around managing so many disparate services and the API contracts and everything else.
They ask themselves right after they get to 90.
Yeah, probably. That's probably a good number. Yeah, exactly.
And the thing that strikes me, though, is that the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Like,
we had this same thing when web services and service-oriented architectures came out. Like, what is too fine-grained? What is the right level of granularity? But even way back in the 90s, like, we were working in an app. It had, like, could use this Corba middleware if you wanted in order to have all these services talk to each other. Yeah. And you had to do this real, like, ugly overhead in order to get the services to actually be remote.
Mm.
Like, you had to write these proxy wrappers and everything. And I was working my old boss, Al, at the time, and he's like, you know what? Let's use the bridge pattern, actually.
Okay.
The old Gang of Four book.
Yeah.
And let's make like a proxy implementation, and let's make what we call the actual implementation, and let's make it a build time switch so you can just tell it, you know what? Just compile everything together into one big ball. Guess what ended up getting deployed? So when you're not programming / leading teams / figuring out how to scale, sometimes you're punching people in the face?
Yeah. I love to box. I've been boxing for a little under 2 years now. I originally started it as like, what can I do to continue getting healthy? I was doing obstacle course races, you know, like Spartans and Tough Mudders. But I'll be honest, a lot of people get sick doing those or get like weird injuries. And I'm like, all right, like I'm starting to push 40 at this point. I don't think throwing myself over a 10-foot wall into a puddle of mud is for me anymore. So yeah, I started boxing for health and then I just fell in love with it. So, and actually now I was selected for Haymakers for Hope, which is a charity boxing match in May. So I'm heavily training right now with a group of guys in South Boston. But yeah, it's tough because right now I'm getting up at about 3:55 in the morning to drive into the boxing gym, which is not ideal. But I do think that actually doing something physical actually helps balance my work-life balance out quite a bit, because I think it's something I can do that's for me. No one actually really cares where I am at 4 o'clock in the morning unless there's really something terrible going on at work. It's something I can do for myself and get something physical done. It helps manage my stress levels. So
now, is there a mick? Like, do you have to ask him to cut you? Like, does he give you negative reinforcement? How does this work?
There is a Nick, actually, who's my trainer, and he is the king of the neg, I think. Like, I get a lot of negative reinforcement, and I wish it didn't work so well on me. Like, I you know, there's a part of me that's just, I hate that it works so well on me, where it's like, you're just the worst box I've ever seen. I'm like, no, I'm not, you know, and I try hard. I'm like, this shouldn't work. You're a grown man, Ken, you know you're okay. But no, like, I think a lot of boxing is, they use negative reinforcement as a motivator. But yeah, no, Nick is great. He's helping train me for Haymakers, and he's 11-0 with guys right now. So I feel like I'm in good hands going into the fight. So yeah.
Haymakers for Hope is one of the links that we will definitely put in our show notes. And the show notes for this show are available at our website. That URL is underserved.libsyn.com. That's underserved.libsyn.com. We'll have a link to Ken's match. You'll be able to donate if you want to help support him in Haymakers for Hope. And also on some of the other topics that we talked about here. We're also looking for folks to participate and give us feedback. So if you are interested in being a guest on the show, if you want to comment on a previous show, you can email us at underserved@syrinx.com. That's underserved@syrinx.com. Underserved is brought to you by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. Do your kids want to see you at more of their soccer games? Does your daughter want you to come to her dance recital? Does your son want you to help him with his homework, and then maybe watch a show together? Of course they do. But it's getting harder and harder for you to have family time because you have to put in so many hours at the office to get your mountain of software projects completed and out the door. And you can't hire people fast enough in such a tight job market to help you catch up. If this is you, then it's time to call Syrinx. We have consultants who can slot into your team immediately to make a positive impact on your schedule. We help you ship software on time and on budget. And we help you get back time to do the important things in life, like having a life. Let us get started today. You could reach us at 888-579-7469, option 1. That number again is 888 579-7469, option 1. Or you can email us at info@syrinx.com. That is info@syrinx.com. More time with your family, brought to you by Syrinx. So what's it like when you're getting in the ring? Like, what goes through your head when you're stepping through the ropes? Is there a flip of a switch? What happens?
It's terrifying. I've done one sort of real fight at this point. It was they call it a developmental match. You know, about 100 people there probably watching it. And you're just nerves the entire time. Because at the end of the day, you're going to be in a ring with another human being who's going to try to hit you in the face as hard as he can. And that's an unnatural scenario, I think, for a human being to enter themselves in. Like, I consider myself, I guess, normal in the regard of I don't really like getting hit in the face. That's not a driver for me. It's terrifying sometimes. So yeah, I think walking up to the ring and then crossing into the ropes is really nerve-wracking. And a lot of it is actually like adrenaline management, like not letting it get to you so much. You're not thinking about all the people watching you or what's going on. And the thing I've been working on the most is when the bell rings, just focusing on the actual match at hand, not worrying too much or overthinking everything about it. Like, I think that's where the training kicks in, is like, it's all more about reflex and responding and not trying to get yourself psyched out or overthink. I mean, one of the interesting things about boxing is even if you win, you're going to get hit, and embracing that and just absorbing that, just know, like, you're going to get hit. The best thing you can do is, if you get hit, to recover and to follow your game plan and keep pushing forward. I think that's one of the hardest things I've had to learn about boxing, especially with sparring, is when someone comes at you with intent to hit you in the face, your first reaction is to back away. Like, your natural human instinct is to literally just get away from this person that's doing this to you. And boxing is about remaining calm and stepping into it, you know, rolling with the punch and going closer to that person. And I think that was by far and away the largest mental block I had to get over, was just to go into a situation that was somewhat unsafe, but to trust myself and my instincts and everything else. So yeah.
It almost sounds like a motivational speaker. Like, you can't back away. You got to lean into it.
Yeah.
You got to go against your instincts and do the uncomfortable thing in order to get ahead and get where you want.
At Rulala, our CEO, Mark, was always like, boxing is a great metaphor for entrepreneurship, you know, like, and I'm like, yes, probably, you know. There's like the Rocky quote from one of the Rocky movies. He's like, you know, it's like about life. And, you know, one of the things I absorb it is, it's not about hard you hit. It's about how hard you get hit and keep moving forward. I actually think that I do take some of those lessons into being a leader, because I don't think of my value is like leading people when things are going well. I think it's actually when something absolutely goes wrong and you have to manage the way out of it. I think that's where leadership emerges. And I think, I guess maybe psychologically under the covers, there is an aspect of boxing that resonates with that for me, which is, it's easy if you're winning and there's no adversary, there's no adversarial conflict. It's what you do with adversarial conflict that actually defines who you are.
I think a lot of folks in the technology area, if they are thrust into a management position or get promoted, or it's just kind of where they end up in their career, that when that conflict can come at them, the same sort of human instinct kicks in, like, yeah. I want to back away from this. I don't like this. It's uncomfortable. I don't want to lean into it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it definitely takes some getting used to.
I mean, I think the first time I had to have an uncomfortable conversation with another human being in a management capacity was like one of the worst moments of my life, because you're sweating. You don't want to do it. It's super uncomfortable. Having to look somebody in the eye and be like, you're not doing well and we're going to part ways, is one of the hardest things I've had to do to another human being. I've done startups for a while, so having to execute like a massive layoff of friends, people you've worked with for years, is one of the definite hardest things I've ever had to undergo. But at the end of the day, like, getting through that, I really feel like that's where you cut your leadership teeth, is not hiring people and having everything go great, but actually managing performance and actually having to do things that are hard. If you have any amount of empathy and you're not a sociopath, it's definitely hard for a human being to do.
So when you come out of the boxing training in the morning, do you come in work looking like Ed Norton in Fight Club and like, oh, I fell down some stairs?
Yeah, my biggest threat, and this hasn't happened yet, but I call it being raccooned, which is when you break your nose and you get the two black eyes. Like, walking into work like that would be absolutely mortifying. Like, I can't. I've been clear that I've sort of told work at our board, you know, like, I'm in a board meeting and I just look like a total mess, you know. But yeah, no, work is actually super supportive of this. So thankfully, I'm pretty transparent about my morning activities. But no, there is always like, I don't want to get my face messed up. Like, I'm terrified of that.
So do you do anything with your kids in order to kind of get them interested in technology, the next generation?
Yeah. Well, they're both into music, which is great, because I do think there are bridges between technology and music. I was a musician as a kid growing up, loved it.
What'd you play?
Violin, trumpet, and then I switched to bass and drums in college.
Oh.
saying, you know, programming was actually like a side gig till my music career took off. But, you know, it ended up sticking. So I'm happy. I'm happy with the path I chose. But we actually just put a piano in for them. But like one of the coolest things I've gotten from my oldest daughter is the Harry Potter like program your wand kit. Like it was like a big thing around Christmas this year. But basically it's like Scratch and they can make, they have like an embedded wand with an accelerometer and stuff in it. But you can like code behaviors and then do stuff with the wand and stuff happens on the computer screen, which is like an awesome way to teach kids how to program. Especially if they're like super Harry Potter nerds, you know, like. It's a fantastic way to bring some of that thrill of like, I wrote this and things happened to a kid's. My youngest, not so much yet, but my oldest is definitely really starting to show like, you know, they're starting to really be interested. They both love Legos, which is great because I love Legos. I don't know anybody who doesn't love Legos. So yeah.
So actually, both in the travel industry,
yeah.
Steve Coffer, the first season 2 episode, talks about Legos being one of his kind of formative, you know, forays into building things before you got into programming.
My parents loved that I loved Legos because I could just get up on Saturday morning and I would just build stuff. I had the, you know, the primary color Legos, you know, you had like the blue and the red and the yellow and just build like these ugly looking spaceships or something like that. But now with the kits, it's so impressive, like all the different kits and everything. And my older daughter loves building like the big Harry Potter castles. Like she's starting to do those, which are really impressive. My wife actually got into Legos this year. She built like the gingerbread house for Christmas. Got it on our man. So yeah, I think we're rapidly becoming a more Lego-oriented family, which is a lot of fun.
I remember when, yeah, we had like probably Duplos when you're real young, then like the primary color Legos. Then when they had the space ones, when those came out, those were the coveted ones. My brother and my cousin and I would all get together and either collaborate or fight over, you know, who got what Legos and what we were going to build together.
The night ones were cool too. And they started having like the horses and stuff like that. Oh, they had all like the, yeah. Now it's like everything. Now there's Marvel and Star. I love Star Wars. So Star Wars Legos are great. I still, my wife bought me a giant Yoda, like the Yoda one to build. I haven't built it yet, but it's like sitting in the corner waiting for me to have like a few spare hours. So
one of my daughters really likes the Legos and they've made like this Lego Friends, I think they call it.
Okay.
And it seems kind of aimed at younger girls and they build like this whole immersive environment that they can then do pretend with. I'm just waiting for her to get into like stop motion video with it or something.
Oh man, yes. I love the creativity of it because they'll play with the Lego sets afterwards. It's great to see. And I like to see them build. Like I consider myself like someone who just likes to build anything, whether it's companies or organizations or code or hardware. So it's great to see. And that's something I can share with my daughters, which is great. Like one of the things that you're always worried about as a parent, I think, is like, am I going to have anything in common with these kids? Are they going to like the same stuff that I like? Because otherwise being a parent might be terrible. But you know, to see those shared interests arise and having something you can really dig into and share your love of something with a child is phenomenal.
You guys do any gaming together, like video games or?
Yeah, Ada loves Minecraft. Oh, I love Minecraft too. You know, so I'm teaching her how to play Minecraft and get more involved in that universe. You know, I do a lot of like really kind of more hardcore strategy gaming and a role-playing gaming type stuff like Witcher. I started just playing RimWorld, which is fantastic. But yeah, we do board games too. Like I think doing board games and puzzle games is a lot of fun. We have tons of board games. Usually that's what I will buy them for a birthday gift. I'll run out and try to find a cool board game we can play together. So we have some, they're all derivations of kind of pop games, like memory games that are themed in a certain way. Gaming is a pretty big part of what we do. I was amazed. They got Don't Break the Ice, which was a game that was actually around when I was a kid. To watch them play that for hours, it's really cool to watch because it's like, wow, this is not a super complex game that it's been around forever that they still drive joy out of. And actually, we just signed Ada up for Chess Wizards. She's starting to get into chess. So I started teaching how to play chess and that's been a lot of fun too because I haven't played chess in a long time. So it's kind of fun to play it with your daughter and teach her the ins and outs of chess.
I never got any good at it. I knew like the sucker's mate opening and that was
about it. Yeah, never great at it. I had friends who were like deep into chess. I learned an appreciation for it. And I knew a couple of things. But no, I was never a wizard at it. I think it's one of those cool games that it has like a lot of different permutations. Like I have a friend who's deep into Go, which I never got into, but I've always wanted to because I think those games are really kind of cool and interesting with all the different permutations. And I mean, there's a reason that it's when they do like man versus machine, it's chess, right? Because I think it is one of those games that there are a thousand ways to execute a game. So it's pretty cool.
The other one they've been doing is poker.
Okay.
And now the AIs are really starting to beat up on the top
humans. Oh no, we have nothing left.
So when you were mentioning the Harry Potter wand, the thing that occurred to me is, like, I think about us with our gateway into programming. Like, we saw something on the screen, thought that was cool, but now they have something in the actual physical world, an IoT device, if you will. They're doing an integration with the computer, and they get to see that. And yeah, that must be super exciting to be a kid and see that come to life.
I can't imagine. You know, I think about what I would have thought of, like, smartphones as a kid, and just that they're sorcery. You know, like, there's just, like, you know, I mean, even when I was going into college, it's like, if I had a Pentium, like, that was cool, right? Like, I could run a video game on this thing that isn't, like, big giant blocks of pixels dancing back and forth. But yeah, no, I mean, it's the acceleration of technology. And that's what I love about the kind of the maker universe, that you can build these, like, circuits really cheaply and easily now, and that it does make, like, accelerometers accessible. Like, I wonder what they'll think, and I wonder what's coming, right? Because, you know, with the advent of AI and programming tools getting much more accessible and easy to use, like, I think it's, I don't know, I keep on thinking we're at an inflection point, and then it keeps on astounding me that we're not, that things keep on accelerating even faster than I imagined. So, yeah.
So to stay fit and help make weight, we were talking ahead of time, you do intermittent fasting.
I do intermittent fasting. Yes, it's, you know, what is it, 16-8 rotation right now? So yeah, I eat between 12 and 8 every day. Yeah.
All 7 days, no days off.
No days off. Yeah. Breakfast is the easiest thing to drop for me. I work out, and usually that kills some of the hunger. And then, you know, I drink coffee. I'm not like a no food, no water, like no drinks type person. So I do coffee and water. And yeah, I get used to it. I don't know if I could do, like, the whole day fasting, because a lot of people do, like, the whole, like, the 1 day or the 3 day fast. I don't think I could do that. I'm happy with the cadence, and I think it does help me, like, maintain weight and stuff like that. So I've been a big fan of it. Yeah.
Been doing it a little over a year. I got down 30 pounds.
Wow. Okay.
And then back up 10 with the holidays and everything.
Yeah.
But since the first of the year, I've fooled around with it a little, tried tweaking one parameter at a time to see what works well. And it seems like the sweet spot is get up, drink some water, walk the dogs, couple cups of coffee in the morning, more water, just water.
Yeah.
And then don't break the fast until after noon. And then I've tried 16-8, 7 days a week for a while. Then I started trying to shorten my window.
Okay.
To make it, like, only 5 or 6 hours worth of time that I'm allowed to eat.
Wow.
And then my oldest daughter's vegan, so I've been trying to steer more that way than meat eating.
Okay.
Or binging on, you know, 3/4 of a large pizza once.
Once
I break the fast.
Yeah, I have a bunch of friends who are into, like, endurance sports that swear by the veganism thing. I eat paleo, so it's like vegetables and meat, and I try to do lower carb stuff. That does it for me. Like, eating out, if you're doing any kind of, like, vegan or any kind of restrictive diet, is always the nightmare, which is why work travel is always terrifying for me, like, trying to find a restaurant in a place where I can probably get something that doesn't completely throw me over the edge. Because I'm one of those people, if it's like, all right, fine, I'm having 4 slices of pizza, and I just blow it. Am I have beer too now? Like, you know.
Oh, the alcohol is the one.
Oh, yeah.
Having the window kind of helps, because if your window ends at 8,
yeah,
then at, like, 8:30, you're like, oh, I can have a beer. No, I can't.
Yeah, it forces you to behave. That's why 8 o'clock is a good cutoff, because at that point, yeah, no, nothing. I'm not going to make good food or drink decisions after 8 o'clock at night.
No, or after 2 beers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's actually the hardest part about actually the boxing training, is that I love craft beer. Like, I am a huge craft beer guy. And my friend sent me a text this week, like, hey, I'm going to Treehouse. Can I pick you up anything? And I'm like, no.
No, you cannot.
You could, like, I'm throwing a big Super Bowl party. I'm like, I will pay for some of the beer to be at my house for the Super Bowl party, but, like, I can't drink any of it.
All right, favorite Treehouse beers, if you were to imbibe?
Oh, goodness. That's a tough call. I'm blanking on the name of their black IPA that I had recently that was really good.
I like pretty much all their doubles. Like,
their doubles are phenomenal. Like, yeah, I don't want to say I stick to doubles, because I feel like it's a good bang for my buck with drinking Treehouse beer, but no.
There's Green, there was Haze. There was this one, like, I think it was called 55, that was good for a while. You pretty much can't go wrong. Although I got the stouts from there, which are wicked expensive. They're like, I don't know, $10 or $15 a bottle. And I figured out afterwards that they contained actual coffee.
Yeah.
Because I was up at, like, midnight. Why am I so wired? And there was a bunch of coffee in the stouts. So I tend to stick to the doubles.
Usually, like, my standard is, like, Julius and Haze. Usually, like, I get the Julius. That's the flagship. It was the first one I had, and I sort of fell in love with Treehouse at that point. And then Haze is just a really well-balanced double IPA. And I do a bunch of Trillium too, you know, because it's easier to get, because I work in Boston.
Yeah.
I actually got their metal series, which was really cool, because there's, like, you know, there's heavy metal, And they did black metal and death metal around like the holiday season, which were like their black IPA and their triple IPA, which were just, were really good too. So yeah, we're really spoiled with the IPA scene in New England, I have to say. Like between Treehouse and Trillium, it's like, you know, kid in a candy store.
Yeah, it has gotten a lot better. My sister and brother would get me like Pliny the Elder from California. And I was like, oh man, like that's the one and only. But now the New England boys can give them a run for their money.
Absolutely. I feel like a bit of a snob when I'm like, well, Alchemist. I mean, you know, Hetty Topper is great. But, you know, like, if it, like, I remember when Hetty Topper was the best thing I ever had, too. You know, yeah. So I'm just like, this IPA bubble that exists right now is spoiled me. I'm totally spoiled. And I feel bad for a lot of my friends that are not in the IPA, because you go to a beer and wine store and it's 70% IPA these days.
Yeah.
So if you're in like a Kolsch, it's like, we don't do much Kolsch pioneering here in New England. So
around Oktoberfest, there's a place called Black Hat Brew Works in Bridgewater.
Okay.
They make an Oktoberfest style beer that is so good. It's like the ones that you see them like with the mass 1 liter
kegs. Okay. Yeah.
At Oktoberfest in Germany. And that's so good. I have like a, it's called a U keg. It's like a gallon keg with CO2 thing in the top. So
okay.
It'll stay fresh for 2 weeks.
Oh,
and
nice.
Pour like it's on tap.
Oh, nice.
I'm over there all the time in like October. Like, all right, got any more?
Oh, man. I'll have to try. I haven't been to that brewery yet, so I'll have to try that. And luckily, I won't be trading in October, so or September. It'll be great.
There you go.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome.
Well, Ken, thank you very much for coming down today. We appreciate you sharing your stories and lessons learned.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And we wish you the best of luck with your Haymakers for Hope.
Thank you. I will need all the luck in the universe to get through this, I think, but I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Well, we'll all be pulling for you in May, everyone from Underserved.